This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, I hope you enjoyed the daily updates that I presented from Grand Rapids, Michigan, there at the International Brotherhood of Magicians annual convention. And I've got a couple more conventions I'm planning to attend later this year. And so if you enjoyed those updates, I think you'll enjoy the next ones then as well. So it's important to always keep up to date with what's going on and where I'm going. And the best way of doing that is to subscribe to our newsletter. We have a weekly newsletter. And if you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there is a tab there that says subscribe. And this way that you can not only subscribe to the podcast, but also there is a form you can complete with your name and email, and you'll be emailed weekly newsletters absolutely free. And also our newsletter subscribers get the some of the first information that comes out about some, not only the upcoming podcast, but also what's going on this week, and sometimes some new contests and things that we announce there as well. So anyhow, be sure to go over and check that out then too. Just another little service I'd like to provide, and I hope again that you enjoy these podcasts. If so, I'd appreciate if you could go to iTunes, if you're an iTunes listener, and just give us a 5-star review and just let us know what you think of the podcast, so this way that it helps with our ratings and our ranking. We'll move on up then and get more popular with other people, other magicians. I'm constantly adding new people, new listeners, and so help share the podcast with others and spread the word of the magic word. Well, this week I'm going to introduce you to someone perhaps you probably don't know or haven't heard of. He's a local magician here in Houston, Texas, named Kurt Miller. Now, Kurt, as he explains in our chat over here, of kind of how that he got started and working at the Magic Island here in town, and how that he got from okay to good to better and best, and also his evolution, how he became an illusionist. And also, while I was at the IBM convention, a lot of people were asking me about being the entertainment director for the Magic Island that's going to be reopening here in Houston. The anticipated date is going to be November the 15th. And so rather than going and explaining this to everybody with all the details of what's happening to Magic Island and about my new responsibilities, I have, as we were talking about this, Kurt and I embedded this into the podcast. So this way that you get an update on what's happening at the Magic Island then as well here in Houston. I think you'll enjoy hearing a little bit of that. But then we also talk with Kurt about his ability to plan for upcoming shows. In particular, he has an annual holiday show during the month of December in a large resort, which is in Galveston Island, just south of Houston. And each year he has to go through a certain process. He starts in January, believe it or not, for something that's going to be happening in December. And so it's an ongoing process. So you just can't plan just a month or two in advance without having a lot of headaches and turning your hair gray or pulling it out. Anyhow, he has a very concerted effort of what he does, and he gave us a very good lecture a while back at our local magic club about this, and I thought it was worth pursuing to share some of that information then with you, so you kind of get the idea of what it takes actually to plan for a large illusion show that is an annual event. Now, that is in between, of course, all the rest of the stuff he does, because he is a full-time professional magician, and he's constantly working at trade shows and also a lot of corporate events, whether he's doing illusions or close-up cocktail strolling, hospitality suites, and that kind of thing. Again, he's one of these guys who you haven't heard of, but that's because he's not really hanging out with magicians. That's because he's keeping his head down and working. He's one of the real workers in our business, and so I thought it best that you hear a lot of this from his mouth and not from mine. So let me introduce to you this week Mr. Kurt Miller here on The Magic Word. Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com. And today I have a guest, again, everybody I talk with are friends. And if it's not somebody I've known for a very long time, it is someone who I have just gotten to know, who is a great guy that I want to introduce to you guys, because I know that you would like them also. Well, this is someone who is not necessarily as well known in the magic fraternity worldwide, but he is one of these guys I kind of call like Will Fern, being a 40-miler. That is, he's kind of, you know, big in the 40 miles around our area here in Houston. And the reason he is because that he he is constantly busy as an illusionist, as a corporate magician, doing trade shows, big theater stage shows, walk around close up. I mean, I have worked with him for many years, going back to the Magic Island here in Houston. And so it's somebody who, once that you get to know this guy, you'll love him also just as much as I do. And also, you will come to respect him even more after we talk about some of the things we're going to discuss here today, to hear his background, but also how that some of this information he's going to talk to you about here today, I hope, is going to be able to be applied to your magic to make it even better the way that you plan for it. And who am I talking with? I'm talking to Kurt Miller. Hi there, Kurt. How you doing?
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me today.
You're welcome. It's always good to be had. So I wanted to talk with you about, well, I mentioned the Magic Island, that you and I kind of go back, way back, you know, to the Magic Island. The Magic Island first opened, was it 1982, I think it
was? Yes, it was a private club initially.
Right.
And I was here when it opened. I was in college. Mm-hmm. I had just started college, and I was working at Circus Restaurant doing close-up magic 3 nights a week. And then after I would do my 3 hours at Circus, I would drive up and do the comedy clubs after that. And I would do the probably the second shift on the comedy club. So I was working my little young tail off back
then. When you said you were working in the circus and then also at the comedy clubs, were you working sound and light? Because I know that
you were actually performing, doing magic? I was doing magic.
No kidding. Yeah. I did not know that you were doing that back then, too.
I was young and ambitious, and I had business cards at 13 up in Indiana. By the time I was 15, I had my first big show. I was traveling all over the Midwest, couldn't even drive yet, and I was doing a lot of shows up there. So by the time I arrived in Houston when I was 18, I had already done a lot of shows and had a lot of experience behind me and thought I was much better than I actually was. And then when I was 19, I auditioned for the Disney Channel and got on that. I was working a lot in college doing magic, and I kind of burned myself out back then because I had been doing it at that point 8, 9, 10 years nonstop pretty much. And it was always about the work for me. I was never interested in being a star. I wasn't interested in being known, really. I just wanted to work.
And did you put yourself through college performing,
yes.
Basically?
Well, I had a scholarship, and then I made all my spending money doing magic.
Where'd you go to school?
U of H.
Okay. And did you study drama and business?
I did. Or? I got my minor in drama. I was going to major in it, and then the practical side of me said, no, you need to get a practical degree. So I got my degree in radio television. I was very interested in television production, and then after college, I did pursue that. I spent 2 years working for two different TV stations, and I thought at that point the magic career was done. That was something I did as
a part
kid.
Of your old life.
And
yeah.
I had moved on.
Yeah.
And it was just a total fluke that I ended up back doing magic again.
What was that fluke?
That fluke was that I had, when a couple of magicians that I'd known from the old days, Richard Hatch and Charles Green, found out that I did video production, they had contacted me and said, can you do my demo reel? And I was working at a TV station, and I said, yes, I can. I'm working at night. I have access to all this stuff, which
right.
we now take for granted. But back then, yeah. it was $200 or $300 an hour to rent those facilities.
Yeah.
And so I did their demo tapes, and it was really Charles Green's magic that got me interested again, because I was watching it, and I just said, wow, there is a professional. There is a guy who's unlike any magician mm-hmm. I have ever seen. And again, another worker, a guy out in the trenches doing work. And I happened to mention to Richard Hatch, you know what? I'm thinking about getting back into magic. And literally 2 days later, he called me and said, there's been a big shakeup at Magic Island. All the magicians quit.
Oh, I remember that night.
Do you remember?
I was there with him. He and I, Charlie McFarlane, and I think Bill Palmer, I think there were the four of us, and Banachek or Steve Shaw may have
yeah.
been there. And we all, that one night, I don't remember what it was. It was the catalyst. But, you know, I think Dick said, you're going to walk? I said, well, I'm walking out. You going to go with me? And I said, yeah. We all got all packed off, and we all left
wow.
that night. It's all the magicians disappeared.
That's crazy. So there was yeah. no magic at Magic Island.
Well, there was until about 8:30, or, you know, I think. Because we were working, and I think we just got started. And then, again, I don't remember what the catalyst was. Do you remember what he told you, why
it was
a shakeup?
It was an ownership issue. From what I was told, there was a fight between the owners and the talent.
Yeah.
The classic story.
Yeah. There was. And, we had all walked out.
That's
all
nuts.
The close-up. I mean, they still had the stage guy working, but there was no close-up after that
wow.
evening, or for that night.
Unbelievable. Well, Richard said, if you're thinking about getting back into magic, now's the time. I'll recommend you. And I was frank with him. I said, I haven't done any magic in years.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be good. And he said, well, there's nobody else right now. So I went and auditioned the next day, dusted off my tux, my cards, ran through the ran through a few of the old routines. I auditioned for Scott Hollingsworth, and I started the next night, and Scott told me, you may not be good now, but you will get good.
Yeah, you will. That's right. You're just doing it over and over, and that was the thing I think about the Magic Island, certainly, is that I don't think that any of us were as good as what we became as a result of, as anyone would be, as a result of repetition. The more often you do it, same thing with restaurants. That's a good place to break in some new material, as you know, and doing it over and over. And the same thing at the Magic Island when you're working those shifts. Unlike the Magic Castle, the Magic Island always has been something that was not necessarily on time. In other words, that at the castle, the close-up rooms are every 45 minutes, and stage shows at certain times. I mean, it's on the marquee right there. Well, this just happens to be whenever that there are enough people to fill the room. And if there are too many people, then they rotate pretty quickly. I mean, they'll knock on your close-up door, as you recall, and say, hey, you know, wrap it up. We're going to bring in the next group, you know.
And that was the good and bad part for me. I spent 4 years there, and the problem for me was during, well, again, it's a double-edged sword. During the busy times, we were expected to go virtually nonstop. When I first started there, there were two of us rotating per room. Then the owners moved us to one in each room, and it took exactly a minute and a half for that room to empty after my show mm-hmm. and refill, and he would say, start the show! Yeah. And the air conditioning wasn't that great in there, and I tell you, Bob, I don't know about you, but about show number 15, it was just,
pretty hot.
Pick the card!
Yeah.
You know, it was very hard, and I would have to have these little conversations with myself. You want to be here. There's nowhere else you'd rather be. You're going to have a great time. They've been waiting for 45 minutes. You'd walk in that room, they'd be like, where have you been? But yeah. I treasure it. And really, the last year I was there, I saw the writing on the wall for me, and I started working on my stage material in the Ramesses. Remember
right,
that
that's
room?
What I was going to say, because I remember that you were actually doing an arm chopper.
I
thought, he's doing close-up, and he's doing an arm chopper right here on the table.
A lot of, not a lot, but some of the things I still do, my in-and-out handcuff routine, sucker egg, arm chopper. I worked out a lot of those routines there at Magic Island, doing them 14 times a night. That routine gets good in a couple of weeks, because you can tweak it within a few minutes.
Right.
Like
right.
Now, I may have a week between shows sometimes,
right.
And you go, okay, unless you videotape it, you don't remember the subtleties.
That's true.
So it was great.
Well,
for that.
That's an advantage, certainly, of a theater like that where you can do it over and over because you have a place to be bad. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but some place to rehearse, if you will. Because, I mean, you got it down, you know what you're doing, but you know how to tweak it because it's still good. It may be solid, but it can be more solid because you're starting to tighten those things. For an example, I remember there was a routine that I did that was, I think, just the UPC gag, you know, basically. And I think I was getting 5 minutes out of it, you know, with some jokes and everything. And Scott Hollingsworth was watching in the back of the room then one time and was saying, you know, if you'll tighten up this, because all these jokes are not hitting, you know. And long story short, I narrowed it. I reduced it to 3 minutes. And so the maybe 9 laughs per minute I was getting over 5 minutes, I was now getting like 15 laughs per minute within those 3 minutes for this routine. And instead of walking back and forth and pacing across the stage, I, you know, would command the center of the stage. The point being is that by him seeing that and me doing it over and over, that I could tweak it the next time to see exactly how it works, what I leave out, what I put back in, or whatever. And not many people have that opportunity, of course, to have a theater where that you can do that over and over, night after night and week after week.
Truly.
Yeah. How long did you work there?
4 years.
4 years. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and you're right. And the other thing is that people will shout out funny things. And if you're doing a lot of them in a row, you go, oh, that's a great line.
Yeah.
And then you can put that in, or things will happen, or you'll think of something funny.
Right.
And that arm chopper routine, which I don't do so much anymore, but that started off as a 2 minute, I mean, it's a, what do you call it? Dissecto? I call it the Vegemagic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had it redone to look like an appliance, but
right.
But that was a 2 minute routine. And by the time I was done with Magic Island, it was 10 and a half minutes. For what essentially is the magic part, about what, maybe 8 seconds? So, yeah, it's a classic example, though. Those things are great. The only thing I have close to that now is our Moody Garden show, when we do 2 shows a day. So it's nice when on the new material that by the end of the run, it's starting to get pretty good.
Yeah, well, no question. Yeah, I think, again, like with anything, the more often that you do it, that it's going to get better as it goes along, certainly.
With that, I remember, well, talking about the Magic Island, of course, is going to soon be reopening. And give me just a minute here, because a lot of people have asked me about this. I'd posted something on the Facebook page about being the entertainment director coming up there. What happened was, boy, long story short, well, it's not going to be short, but the story is that I had been contacted by the television station. They said, we're going to be doing a story on the Magic Island reopening, and can we use some clips from your YouTube video? And I said, sure, that'd be fine. I said, so what's going on? They told me, and I said, well, I used to work there. And so they said, well, do you mind coming down and doing some shoot for the news? And I said, sure, fine. I went down and then found out more about it. And there was a lady there who used to be the one who wrote our checks all the time. And we started talking, reconnecting, and she said, oh, you need to come in and talk to the owner, and we'd like to visit with you. And so we made an appointment, got together, and kind of got reacquainted with the general manager, with the owner, and with the treasurer and some other people. And so it's kind of like, oh, yeah, everybody remembers everybody. And then found out afterwards that, well, they've had a couple other people who have been considered, but they said, you know, you're the one that has the contacts and people, but we are comfortable with you. We believe that you'd be the most qualified. And so, you know, basically we're recommending to the owner that you're going to be it. We just need to have you meet the owner again to kind of reconnect. And so it was one of those things where that, well, do I have it? Well, we need to have his final approval. Okay, which should be rubber stamped. I mean, they're kind of saying, okay, it's like 95% that you're it. So I think I've got the job, so I'm calling it entertainment director pro tem. But the question about the larger question, as far as about like being Magic Island actually opening, the owner is saying November 15th is going to be the projected date for opening, which means that he's telling the contractors and engineers and everybody to, you know, get after it and move 180 miles an hour is what he was telling them as I was sitting there and he was talking to the contractors. And I looked at the blueprints and everything, and they're discussing what all is going to be happening. It's going to be very much, pretty much like what the original one was, as far as where the location of the two close-up rooms and then one large stage. About 160 people, and so the room format will still be the same as to the seats and everything else. I mean, everything's pretty much all been gutted, and it's well over a $2 million project for this whole thing. They're going to put on a whole new roof, because what happened back in 2008 when in September when Hurricane Ike had come through, my wife and I were the ones who were actually the last act that day. They called and said, hey, we're going to be closed because of the hurricane. The next day, then they had the apparently some of the water had leaked into a fluorescent light. The fire department came. I mean, it caught fire. The fire department came, put out the fire. And so during the past 10 years, as I understand it, that they have been just negotiating with the insurance company, because is it due to the hurricane as far as what's being paid, or is it to the fire, or because of the fire department or whatever? So I'm sure there are a lot of issues, but they have been resolved, I guess. But moreover, I guess they're looking at putting some poker room on the ground floor and having a poker club down there, which will help fund the Magic, which will be upstairs. It'll be two separate clubs or two separate entities, basically. And the way that is legal is that you can, as I understand it, is that they can just charge 10 or 20 bucks or whatever for a chair. You own that chair for the night until like 4 in the morning. And so let's say you and I and a few friends go there and we just buy the chair. We buy our food and drink from them for the night. So they make the money on that. But it's just our money on the table. I mean, the Magic Island would get nothing out of that. There's no gaming commission or anything to manage it, because there's no house advantage, there's no house rake or anything that they get for providing us. All they're doing is just selling you the chair, basically. So
private gambling is legal.
That's what I understand.
Right.
Correct, in Texas. I think there are some laws that are about to be in place to confirm all that. I don't know that has all been finalized, but that's kind of what I understand, you know, the workings and the plans are, you know, for that to go forward. And I think it, you know, there's some other clubs, I guess, around Houston that has the same kind of format, as far as, you know, if you want to have something in your house, I guess it's legal that you can have a game in your house, and you can make some money by just selling the chairs to people who are not your friends. I mean, just having people to come into your house and doing that. So they're just making it in a nicer club format with food and drink available, you know. So that's what I understand. But as far as booking the acts, that it's still still way too early because they've got so much to build. Going to rebuild the kitchen, as I said, you know, strip out the roof and put that all in, and just a ton of remodeling, you know, plus permitting and the mold and the air ducts and things that need to be replaced, and some new bathrooms, some stairways, exits, etc.
What about all those wonderful posters that were on the wall? Good question. That was a real tragedy to think a lot of that had gone away.
Either had gone away or had been vandalized or had been desecrated with people just spray painting over it. I remember this huge Alexander poster. Remember that was in that one corner up in the bar. I saw a picture where someone just spray painted over that with something. I mean, it's you can't scrub that off, you know.
Yeah.
As for the props and the pictures and everything, I don't know that they had been taken out by the owner or vandals, nor if they are still there or not. I don't know what the I think that much of the stuff is still available and they can put back in there. So it's going to, I think, still have that Egyptian theme that it always had. But for those who are not familiar with the Magic Island, it was a dinner theater, so that way that people would come and have fine dining. They have a couple of nice bars. They had late night, had a discotheque, and so they'd have dancing and everything in there too, as well as two close-up rooms and then the stage. So people could come for the evening, and one of the biggest mysteries of the Magic Island was how time would disappear. I mean, you'd go there at 7 o'clock, and it's like all of a sudden it's midnight because there was so much to see and do, and they did have fun blackjack, you know, up there. And of course, they had and will have again psychics, you know, and fortune tellers and palm readers. And so you remember Maria and some of the ones that we worked with, you know, way back when. So going to try to get some of the ladies back to do that as well. So it's just a fun evening, you know.
It is. People still talk to me about it all these years later. It was such a back then you didn't exchange cash upstairs. I don't know if they're going to stay with that format.
I think they're going to do the same thing. Yeah,
you would just show your number and then tally up at the end.
Right, when you came downstairs, kind of like country club billing, basically you gave them your number on this card they would give you as you'd come in, and then at the end of the evening, as you were checking out to get your car from the valet, then yeah, they would.
And I will say this too for you magicians who may want to work there. There is no better place to work, possibly the castle maybe, but people come there expecting magic, expecting good magic. They're always in a good mood. And they want to have fun.
That's true.
And when you are doing corporate events or other things like that, you're not necessarily the star of the evening.
Right.
At Magic Island, you are, and you get spoiled. I had a hard time when I first left because I was so used to just great crowds. Every crowd was the best crowd, and I had to toughen my skin and learn how to entertain for the masses a little bit better when I left there. But you will love it. So if you get a chance to work there, please don't hesitate. You'll absolutely love it.
Yeah, it is a fun place to work, certainly. You got a very good point. Whenever you go to restaurants, you're having, or cocktail parties, as you know, whenever you're strolling around from table to table or cocktail group to group, that you're having to reintroduce yourself and to win over these new people. And they're going, who are you? You know, you're just another wandering mariachi kind of. It's like, stay away, you know, basically. But I think with the Magic Island, like the Magic Castle, people come there for magical entertainment. They don't come there for singing. I mean,
it says Magic Island.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I've been at events where I think I was right there on par with the table decorations. So, but not at Magic Island. Every show was a great show, really. And if it wasn't a great show, it was just because of me. It certainly wasn't the audiences. They were always fantastic.
Yeah, they really did have great audiences. They enjoyed magic while they were there. And so, again, that was, it was there for about 25 years, and it was a destination. And a lot of people had come from out of town when they were here for conventions and everything. So it really was. And so after you had left that, after the Magic Island, after your experience for those 4 years, then you decided you wanted to be more of an illusionist. And
well, yes and no. I was a close-up magician, and so that was all I knew for the first 3 years there. Then I started working on my stage act, and I didn't do illusions for a long time. I knew I wanted to get into the corporate market because I had already put my foot in that market, and I liked the income. I liked the audiences. Magic Island had prepared me for the corporate market. We had so many corporate clients at Magic Island, so I felt very comfortable in that environment. And so for many years, I just did a standard stand-up show out of a suitcase, like a lot of you guys do, for the corporate market. But what I found was that a lot of corporate events had much bigger budgets than I was taking advantage of.
Yeah, and, you were underpricing yourself.
And they would gladly have paid more had I had something more to offer. And so,
and you say more to offer, you mean in terms of size for Illusion, or you mean more tricks?
No, not more tricks. I don't think anybody ever cares about the tricks or how many tricks you're going to do in the corporate market. I never get asked that. What they want to know is primarily, are you going to embarrass me or my boss?
That's a good, yeah.
Is sure. Everyone going to have fun because we have a very diverse audience? I get that right. A lot. And that's, I mean, to me, the best selling point of magic is that everybody likes it. If you do it right, young, old, I've done shows where nobody speaks English. You know, it is one of the few forms of entertainment that you can almost guarantee everybody's going to like.
Right.
And so I had good success in that. But I realized that if I could offer something bigger in terms of the size of the show, that's that I could maximize their budget. So I started offering an A and a B and a C show. The A show, they would get a few illusions, levitating somebody from the audience, things that were an easy sell.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of got into doing illusions at that time, but I didn't own anything. I would just rent them from other guys whenever I needed a show.
Yeah.
Well, then eventually I started getting offers to do bigger and bigger things. And I was hiring people from out of town and having girls flown in and having props flown in. Then it got kind of ridiculous. But it all kind of changed in 1995 when I was doing walk-around magic on the 4th of July for a company called Stuart Title, and the guy said to me, do you do the really big stuff, because we have this massive Christmas show every year?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, of course I do.
The answer is always yes.
Always yes, right, in this business?
Then how do I do it?
Yeah. And couple days later, I was in their office giving a big presentation, and I sold this massive show. I mean, it was a huge show where we were having the CEO do a trick and all these big illusions, then fortune tellers and walk around magicians and
right.
Decorations and balloons. I mean, I was way in over my head, but I learned a lot from that. And then I sold it again, and then all of a sudden I realized, wow, there's some serious money in the illusions if you want to go down that path. But I kind of scaled back for a while until the Moody Gardens thing happened. But what I had realized at that point, I had figured out how to be an illusionist, because I am the last guy, in my opinion, you would ever peg as an illusionist. I'm 5'5". I don't move particularly well. I'm not graceful or debonair at all on stage. And I knew this about myself. And so I knew that if I was going to do illusions, I would have to find some way to make the audience buy into it and make them care. And that's mm-hmm. still the fundamental thing of my show. I always ask myself, why should they care about this?
Well, it's the same thing I would think about, you know, thinking about the old time magicians, you know, like Thurston and Blackstone. They were not dancers, you
right.
know, or anything. They were kind of box pointers.
That's a good point, yeah.
But they were surrounded by other people who were dancing and, you know, keeping everything else. And so they were just kind of easily flowing from one place to the other. So they weren't really in the way, but they were still the star. I mean, there's more to just pointing at boxes. You
That's
know?
A good point. But I think all of those guys had something I didn't, and that is a very commanding stage presence. And you know, mm-hmm. I always think of Blackstone Jr. was my hero growing up. I got to meet him when I was 13, and I still have
yeah.
his autograph out there.
Yeah.
He was just the best, I thought. And he had such a command of the stage, and he just owned that stage. And I had to come up with a way of doing that. And I eventually hired a director to try to help me wrap my head around how I was going to do all this big stuff. And
yeah.
And have the audience care about it and not laugh and point.
You know, I remember an interview I heard with David Copperfield many years ago, and I think, and he may correct me, or somebody will if this isn't true, but it seems like that he was being asked, what is the difference between a magician and an illusionist? And he said, 10%. And they can charge more as an illusionist, basically. In reality, it's a lot more than 10%, because when you go and tell them, well, I'm going to provide you with this, this, and this, and I'm going to have lights and sound and that the curtains and, you know, making it a big show, I always try to make my my corporate show sound big, which it is big. I mean, I've got curtains, I've got lights, and you know, everything as well. But I don't bring in a Zigzag or anything like I used to, or I don't do Doves like I used to, or a Subtrunk or whatever. So I don't really have larger types of illusions anymore. That what I think that again would differentiate a real illusionist is someone who does bring in the furniture, you know, as to as props, certainly, and you can justify that easier, I think, to a corporate audience saying, well, I understand, yeah, because he's got to, you know, have a big cargo van to haul this stuff, and plus he has to pay his assistants. I mean, certainly they would realize it, as opposed to me just coming in with, you know, a little nightclub table and curtains, and even though I make it look big, it is not, in reality, as big as what yours would be.
True. I think to a certain extent you have to have some furniture or something they can look at. But I think there are a lot of ways to make your show really be big without having furniture on stage. And, you know, for example, like you said, bringing in a backdrop, bringing in a spotlight, lowering the house lights during
your show.
Music
makes a big difference too.
Sound is the number one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sound, having a great system. I've got this little Bose system. You've probably seen those little tower speakers.
Yeah.
Those little tower Bose systems, the L1s.
Mm-hmm.
Bring that in. You have great sound, good lights, and all of a sudden your show looks huge. Mm-hmm. And like you said, music. I use a media star on the show.
Yeah,
and,
a lot of...
Those three things, and bam, and that... None of that takes up an enormous amount of space.
Most of us are now using music in our shows, certainly. Years ago, I remember when Kerry Pollack was talking about that and talking about the importance of music, because that can add, that is, makes it from, you know, from a good show to a first-class show with just that little bit of something that
right.
separates you from the others, because you have these sound effects or people coming up from the audience that they've got some music playing or some
Absolutely.
Something that happens. It may not take much, and there are so many Bluetooth devices that you can have that don't cost very much, that even if I'm working in someone's home, I'll bring one of these small things and you can operate it from your iPhone if you want, or your iPad. There are so many different ways of doing it. You don't need to have a big mixing board, because some people may think, oh, I'm not going to need any music. You know, if you do it once, you'll be surprised as to how much more impact that has on the audience.
I agree 100%. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just night and day difference, just adding something like music and sound effects.
Yeah. And, of course, there's just a lot you can do in recording your shows easily with your iPhone and whatever else. Do you still do that, as far as record your shows to watch them back again?
Almost every show.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a tiny little camera I stick in my case, and especially if I'm working on new material. But I do tape the shows a lot even now.
Which is, by the way, just kind of go back for just a moment to what you said earlier, that that was where you and I think, got to know each other, because you said that you had recorded shows and done a promo demo tape for both Take a Hatch and Charles Green. You did one for me also.
Right.
You came in the Magic Island when I was working there.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I had used that for years, had that videotape, and it was very well done. That's how far back we go. I mean, I appreciate what you did to kind of help get my career, you know, in
hey,
corporate.
I appreciate those steady commission checks you've been sending me. I mean, it really
sure,
has helped.
You're welcome.
Oh,
you're welcome.
Yeah.
That helped buy this house, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The post office said they're holding them for me. So
bank is too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm glad it helped. Back at Magic Island, you know, I mean, my degree's in video production.
Yeah.
And so I was doing a lot of tapes for other guys and trying to help them out whenever I could. And, of course, it's been great for my show. I've been able to do a lot of the video. We have a lot of video in the show.
Well, that was what I was going to ask next. Not only do you video your show, you say you do the, but also you have a lot of stuff which is really cool before the show even begins.
And during the show too. Yeah.
Oh, okay, talk a little bit about that.
Well, we have a giant screen. Well, we're now talking about, for those of you who don't know, we have a pretty massive show that we do.
That's a good point. Let's back all the way back to talk about the show.
I was rewinding the virtual tape.
What's tape? To what the show actually is, that what culminates as far as what the Moody Gardens, explain what Moody Gardens is and the show you do. So.
Sure. Okay. Well, I still do a lot of corporate events, but we've had this really sweet gig for about, this is our 10th year, so I should get some kind of an award for keeping a gig for 10 years.
As huge as that is, or a month-long thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big show. It started big, but we do this big show at this place called Moody Gardens. It's a destination attraction. It's in Galveston, Texas. And Moody Gardens is a wonderful place to visit if you've never been there. There are three giant pyramids. One's a rainforest exhibit, one's an aquarium, and they have a big IMAX screen. Lots of things to do there. They're very close to the beach, so you can go to the and swim in our crystal clear blue water there in Galveston.
Right. Yeah.
But this will be our 10th year there. We started off doing shows in the convention center as part of their summer series, and we were hired guns. You want a little bit of the history of the show?
Just, yeah, a little bit.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So our first 2 years, we were in the convention center. There was a summer series, and we were brought in as one of the acts.
Did they contact you, or were you proactive to get this show?
They contacted me.
Just out of the blue, because they had seen you down there doing a show for a company or something?
I'm not sure how they had found me, but then they came to see me at a corporate event.
Okay.
They liked what they saw, and they booked me. And this was another one of those Stuart Title experiences, in that they wanted a much bigger show than I had. And I had 6 months to put the whole thing together. Mm-hmm. We had a nice budget, though, so I got Rich Hill involved, who's an illusion designer and builder up in Indiana. I hired a director. I knew the show was going to be more like a play than a magic show from my perspective. So I wanted a director to come in and have an overall view. And in my opinion, it's really hard to have an objective view of your own show. Mm-hmm. And it's always better to get a professional come in to watch the whole thing and give you notes and give your other people notes. And it's also better to have a director come in to help the other people in your show know what they're doing. I found that people in my show tend to respond better to that third person. And I'm still kind of in charge. I can tell him later or before, this is kind of what I'm going for. But mm-hmm. then I turn over the reins at a certain point to him and let him do it.
Right.
But anyway, so we put together this really big show. It went well. We got hired back the next year to do it. We made the show even bigger. And I was able to purchase a lot of large-scale illusions in those 2 years that we did those shows.
Based on the funds you were receiving from those shows, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It was a great gig. But then the hurricane came to Galveston.
Yeah.
And we had a big one. It was a massive hurricane. It shut down the whole island. Do you remember all of that?
I remember very well.
It was so bad, to give you some perspective.
Was that Hurricane Ike?
Yes.
That was 2008.
Yes.
Which was the one we're talking about, the Magic Island, that closed that. Because it hit Galveston much worse.
Same one.
Same one.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it hit Galveston worse than it did here in downtown.
So this was not a good hurricane for magic, is what we're trying to say.
Yes.
But it was so bad that there were sailboats on the freeway.
I think I saw some of those photos.
It was horrible. They shut the whole island down. Moody Gardens was just wiped out virtually. And so we did the show then that next year. That was our second year. But it wasn't the same. Attendance was down. The employees, a lot of them had lost everything. They were gone. And so they canceled the whole thing. So now I had all of these props. I had all of these routines that we had developed. I was very proud of the show. And we had no venue. So in 2010, I rented the Hobby Center.
Yeah.
And we staged,
oh, that's right.
Yeah, we staged our show there. Now, the Hobby Center is a very beautiful theater in Houston. And at that time, and maybe still now, it was the theater to be in.
It was fairly new. It hadn't been open but about 5 years, maybe.
Right. And mm-hmm. all the big acts, the Broadway shows were coming to the Hobby Center. And so you knew if a show was at the Hobby Center, it was going to be good.
It was top
notch. And I felt like that's where we needed to be. I was an unknown. I wasn't going to sell tickets, you know, just by my name. So we rented the Hobby Center, and I spent about $60,000 of my own cash mm-hmm. To rent that show for 2 days, and with all the advertising and all of that.
Right.
And it was very successful. We sold 800 seats at $50 a pop. Well, it doesn't take a math whiz to realize that's about 20 grand short.
Yeah, not going to cover everything. Yeah.
No. So the shows were a success artistically speaking. I was very happy with the shows and the turnout. But we lost money on it. However, I had all this advertising in place now. I had branding in place. We had TV commercials in place, radio commercials in place. All of this money that I had put out and all of these things I had learned about marketing, because
right.
I didn't have to market the show in the old days. Moody Gardens did that.
Right.
So I went back to Moody Gardens and said, what if we did the show, but it didn't cost you anything? And they said, we're listening.
Yeah.
And we got the idea when we went up to see Rook Wilcox up in the Dells. There was another guy doing this similar concept at a hotel there. And so I said, here's the idea. You give us a banquet room, the biggest one you have in the hotel. We will stage the show. We'll bring in everything. Pipe and drape, lights, sound, everything. We'll sell the tickets. You have to do nothing.
Right.
And we'll give you a percentage of the ticket sales, and we will give you 30 tickets per show to sell or give out or whatever you want to do with them.
And did they sell dinner also, or was it
No, no dinner. Just the show. And I remember in the first meeting, they said no, but I kept after them. And I set up another meeting.
How could they say no when they had no other expense?
You know, the funny thing was the owner or the CEO at the hotel at that time was such a nice guy. He didn't want to see me lose money.
Oh.
And he just flat out told me, he said, Kurt, it's not going to work.
You're going to lose money.
I don't want to see you go to all this work and lose money. And he was a great guy. He's no longer there, unfortunately, but I like the new guy too.
Yeah.
And so I kept after him, and we had lunch again. And I just said, I really think it's going to work. And he said, well, what do I need to do? And I said, here's what I need you to do. I need you to stay out of the way. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, when we did the Hobby Center, they seemed like they did everything they could to block us from selling tickets. It was a very miserable experience in terms of dealing with them and trying to market the show. But I said, if you'll allow me to use the Moody Gardens machine on your website to put my stuff, my banners, my posters, to just do what I do, I have all this marketing in place, it will be successful. And so they let us try it. This is back in 2011. And by the second show, we were in the black.
Wow. And you did how many shows?
We 14? We did. At that time, we were doing 2 weeks.
Okay.
Every day. So we did.
You did a couple shows on the weekends, too. Didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. We did 2 weeks straight, 2 shows a day.
Okay. Yeah. And the so they were able to sell the ticket. You sold the tickets, but they allowed you to kind of use their platform, I guess, to.
Yeah, and it was great, and they were very supportive. And it really has been a win-win situation, because we bring a lot of people down to the island who then go and eat and go to attractions, and then they also have something to advertise. Hey, you need to come, because in addition to all the other cool things we have this great magic show happening
right
over at the hotel. So they've been very supportive, and this is our 8th year of doing it in that environment now.
Well, and selling tickets, I was going to ask you about that and getting into the theater. I understand about how that you kind of got into the theater, but initially they were the ones responsible for selling the tickets and everything. You just provided the show, essentially.
That's right.
Paid you. You got X dollars regardless of whether they sold it or not.
Correct. I was a hired gun, and those were the salad days.
Yeah.
That was great. I would go back to that probably in a moment. Yeah. It's a lot less stress on you. And do the, and they would give me a big check and say, just do whatever you want. And it was a playground.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was fantastic.
That's the
and
ideal,
I had that again, if you, when we did the Christmas shows.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was, after our second year of doing the summer show and being successful with it, they brought me back down to the island, and they said, would you be interested in taking over our Christmas show as well? And they were doing, again, back in the convention center in a big room, seated about 1,200 people.
Mm-hmm.
They had a show, and I went and saw it, and there were singers and dancers and aerialists and all the things you'd expect in a Christmas show. And there was dinner. So you got dinner, and then you saw the show.
Right. The dinner was part of the package.
Part of the package. It was a great idea, because you had dinner, you saw this big show, and they brought in the lights, the rock star lighting and everything.
Yeah.
It was a huge stage. It was really quite the production. And then you got tickets to their Festival of Lights, so you could go and walk through that with your family after the show, and it was all included. And dinner was good. Festival of Lights was good. The show wasn't that great. And they knew it. And that's why they asked me to come down and look. And when we had the meeting, they said, well, what did you think of the show? And I didn't know what to say.
You couldn't be honest, too honest.
I didn't want to be too honest, because I didn't want to step on their baby, you know, or insult their child. So I said, well, it had some great points. And they said, no, really, seriously, what did you think? And I told them, I said, there were things that I liked, but honestly, it was kind of flat. And there were no peaks and valleys to the show. I don't know about you, but I'm a big believer And I always make what we call an energy chart for our show. You want to have things get big and bold and wonderful, and then you want to bring it down and get quiet and things in between to keep the audience engaged
right.
through that hour or hour and 15 minutes.
Different emotional roller coaster.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You have to keep them engaged, especially now, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. It seems like I'm just always, squirrel. Nobody has any attention span anymore. So I'm constantly having to refresh the eye and tighten my routines and something to keep them engaged and not looking at their phone for an hour.
Yeah.
But, so anyway, that bothered me, and I said the other thing that bothered me was that as soon as the show was over, the people around me went, okay, now what do you want to do? So there was no emotional impact from the show. There
right.
was nothing particularly memorable about the show.
Yeah,
it was a lot of great eye candy, and so they said, well, what would you do differently? And I said, well, honestly, I don't know anything about singers or dancers, but mm-hmm. in terms of the magic, I would structure it different. So they asked me if I would take over the whole show. And what I didn't realize at that time was they meant, here you go, bye.
It's your new baby.
It's your new baby.
Yeah.
And I didn't really hear from them then for 6 months. I would give them some reports now and then, but... and then they asked me if I would be the marketing director, too. So all of a sudden now, in addition to the summer show, I've got this show, which was literally five times as big as the original shows that we did at Moody Gardens in the convention center.
Right.
And I had to learn about singers and dancers, and I had to hire a choreographer. And I had, long story short, we did the show 4 years in a row, and I had 23 people under me. And that's 23 egos and 23
right.
people all with their own agenda. And it was incredibly stressful. And we did this magical, massive show for 4 years. And then the summertime, we would do my smaller show, which is still a big show,
sure.
in the hotel.
Sure.
But the cool thing about that was, again, we had a budget again, a separate show budget.
Yeah.
And I bought a whole bunch more illusions. So now this place is just... crammed full of stuff. I should never have to buy another illusion.
You say that.
Yeah, that's true.
One of the things that I want to get to here now is your preparation, because obviously that these things just don't happen. You just don't buy a bunch of illusions and
no.
then you kind of script them out and you have a little bit of music and you rehearse and for a month. You lectured for our local magic club here a few years ago, and it was one of the most fascinating lectures, because you said here in January, well, we have the show in December, but immediately after that, and then each month. Can you kind of walk us through what you do?
Well, yeah, I was talking about the Christmas show, and there's a process. You have to plan so far ahead on these things because there are so many details to take care of, and in the end, it is your name on the marquee.
Right. Right.
And if that show, anything in the show goes badly, I've always felt like this, they blame you.
You're personally responsible, sure.
And rightfully so,
sure.
really. And so, in January, it would be all business, trying to get all the contracts signed, trying to get everything squared away, and then, you know...
No, the contracts, you mean with the Moody, or your venue?
Yeah,
with your performers, your
artists.
Well,
then I would start hiring people. Yeah, I didn't usually hire the talent that early, but a lot of the tech people you want to get nailed down, especially during the holidays.
Good point.
People get busy and everything.
So you tell them in January, start doing the contracts.
A lot of that stuff, yeah. And really, January and February were the time that I would start shopping for illusions, too, because they wanted a new show every year,
mm-hmm.
and... to me, the hardest part about doing a big show, especially in a regular venue, is that you owe it to the audience and a lot of times your clients to bring something new.
Yeah.
Singers can go in and do their classic songs and that's
mm-hmm.
fine,
mm-hmm.
but they want new. Well, my problem is I don't know how to get something to a level in just a couple of months. To me,
mm-hmm.
I have to work it in front of a crowd. I have to just work it until
right.
and bring it up there, because when people are paying sometimes $90 a ticket to sit down front, they expect it to be great.
Right.
And for me, it's never about the trick. It's about the routine that goes around it.
Right. So you could repurpose an old illusion by putting different color of paint, or like you have with the one we were just talking about, the elevator illusion that's now like a phone booth kind
yes.
of thing. If you got smoke, and so you can kind of repurpose something, but you have a different routine around the same illusion, essentially.
Yeah. And you can do that sometimes. But a lot of times I would come up with an idea for a routine, and then I would find a prop that would fit that or commission an illusion to be built that fit that. For an example, I had an idea of sawing myself in half. I thought it would be funny
right.
to get into an argument with my insurance agent. We have this animation that plays that's kind of like the Geico Gecko. But
right.
this guy is an iguana because I couldn't afford the gecko.
By the way, that's where we kind of got sidetracked while we were talking about videos, because you got these big image magnifiers.
That's right.
On this. Okay, so you have this before and during the show.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
So this video plays this animated character with a cigar hanging out of his mouth, sitting at a really messy desk with a sign that says low budget insurance. And he just rags on me for thinking that I'm going to be covered if I try to saw somebody in half from the audience,
yeah.
which I'm very excited about doing. And so we have this back and forth dialogue, and then eventually I say, you know, well, how about this? Could I saw myself in half? And he says, you want to saw yourself in half? Yes. With that saw right there. Uh-huh. The rusty one. Right. Yeah, that's fine. So then I go into this
premise.
Deal. Yeah, so it started with that idea that I would have an argument with the insurance thing, and then this whole illusion came about from that. But my concept was, oh, well, I'm going to get in this thing. I'm going to saw myself in half. I'm going to stand up vertically, saw myself in half,
right.
fling my legs across the stage, and then realize that I hadn't thought it through.
How am I
and I can't get
there?
The legs back, right?
Yeah.
And then comedy ensues, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, getting that illusion designed, getting it built, then right. coming up with a routine, getting the director involved. Eventually, we settled on a 1920s routine with the girls in flapper outfits, you know, and one was the dumb blonde and the other was kind of ditzy.
I remember when you were working on that, you and I were working at the Houston Museum of Natural
yes,
Science.
Yes, that's right.
And you just received that,
just
and you were
it.
Just working on all these different routines.
And that's why I did it there, so I could work it in front of a crowd
right,
again,
right.
Over and over and over.
Right.
And so it has evolved a lot over the years.
So in January, February, you're working on contracts.
That's right, right. So contracts, finding new things, finding new illusions and this and that. And then coming into spring is then when I would start picking music and working a lot of the music out into the show, what we were going to do.
Do you have issues like with ASCAP and that kind of a thing as far as paying for
no,
the rights?
Hotel took care of all of that.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, the Moody Gardens took care of all that, so luckily I didn't have to worry about that.
Okay.
So we were all covered there. And then moving into the summer then, I would start looking at talent and start trying to figure out some of the other magic that was in the show and what I was going to do. And then moving into fall then, that's when we would hire the dancers, we would have auditions, and we would start moving into marrying the choreographer's work and the director's work together. So what we would do is the choreographer would go away, rehearse all the dance numbers by himself with the studio. We would work on the magic in another facility. And then as we got closer and closer to the venue, we would work them together. And then eventually, we started working a lot of the dancers into the actual magic toward the end. So, yeah, it was a year-long process.
And then in the fall, as I recall, that wasn't your wife teaching at the time? And so you
yes.
went and did some of the schools?
Well, I still do that. I have an idea for all you workers here, and you may already do this, but this works great for me. My wife is a teacher. Now, if your wife's not a teacher, you can find somebody who is, and this is a killer thing for me. So, and I just did this last week. I have a brand new routine called Grand Paper where I play this old man. It's a torn, restored newspaper, but the old man keeps having issues with a cat, and the newspaper gets torn accidentally, and he gets more and more angry until finally the newspaper's all shredded up, and then he restores it. But anyway, it's this long routine all set to the music. Whenever I'm working on something new, I go to her school, and I do it two or three times for different grade levels. And I'm talking as young as 4 or 5 all the way up till about 10 is your ideal age. And the reason that I do that is, A, if something goes wrong, it's not that serious. It's not a corporate crowd. It's not somebody paying $50, $60
right.
a ticket.
Right, right.
right. But the biggest reason is that they're brutally honest with you.
Good
and
point.
Adults will look you right in the eye and go, that was fantastic.
right? yeah.
But kids won't. And I'll tell them, this is a preview audience. I'm going to ask you what you thought about it afterwards. And they will look me right in the eye and say, yeah, I didn't get that. I thought this was horrible. I learned so much from those kids. And on this routine that I'm working on now, I learned several things that I never would have thought of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I sat on the cat originally, the virtual cat, they didn't get it. Oh, I changed a couple things, tweaked it for the next show. It was more clear then.
Yeah.
So it really, really is a great thing to go in, do it for these kids, and then just ask them, what did you think? Did you like it? Did you like this? What didn't you like? And just quiz them all after the show. And I'm telling you.
So you get immediate feedback right there.
It's immediate feedback, and then you change it. Go in the next day, do it for some more kids. The kids love it because they're getting free entertainment. The teacher loves it because she doesn't have to teach for that 15 minutes. And it's just a win-win situation.
And you're not having to go through the school necessarily to get them to approve you to do a...
Zero.
Yeah.
It's not a paid thing, but it pays off for you 1,000 times over. I call it my secret weapon.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good idea, good advice.
Thanks.
Then on that, too. So then that is in the fall where you're kind of doing that, and then you actually have your real dress rehearsals.
Yeah, well, then I work the stuff into the corporate shows as much as I possibly can.
Sure.
So, you know, we all get busy in the fall, you know, from October through December with the corporate. So I would work a lot of those routines now into the corporates and get their feedback in front of paying adults, you know. And then we would move into major rehearsals with the whole cast and everyone.
Here, or do you go to the banquet hall or to the Moody Gardens and rehearse there? Or do you?
No, not at Moody Gardens. We
go to a dance
another
studio?
Facility.
Okay.
A bigger. I didn't have it. I have a rehearsal room here in my house that we can rehearse some of the routines. But once you get a lot of bodies involved, you have to move into a bigger space. And then we would tape off an area the size of the stage.
And how many people do you typically have?
Well, we had in the Christmas show at that point, we had 8 dancers, we had 2 singers, and all of those people interacted. We had techs running all over the place, moving props in and out.
Mm-hmm.
We had a stage manager, so all those people had to be there and be speaking the same language.
Right, right. So you get everybody together for these dress rehearsals.
Right.
What, 2 weeks before the actual
beginning? No, about a month before.
A month before.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we would do weekly rehearsals. As we got closer, if it wasn't there, I would schedule biweekly rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
But
do you pay them for rehearsals or just for shows? Or
It depends. The dancers, we built that into their contract.
Which you had, again, done in January.
Yes.
So they can't renegotiate that, said, hey, we've already signed the deal.
No. Well, the dancers typically be booked in the summertime.
Okay.
And that's a whole separate thing working with dancers. These are very flighty individuals.
Where do you find them?
Well, there's lots of places. Our choreographer had great connections, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He worked at a couple of different dance studios. We would post auditions, but there are venues online where dancers go to check for gigs. And the same thing with actors, by the way. If you ever need to hire, we have a professional actress that's in our show that's been there for 10 years. And I've hired other actors occasionally to be in the show. And there are theater websites and places that people go, even Craigslist, believe it or not,
really?
That people go to find gigs.
Yeah.
And there's a great place called Dance Force Houston where a lot of them go to look for different jobs coming up and things like that. But I would just spread the word. I've even contacted, this is some good advice actually, if you need text for your show, if you contact some of these high schools that have big theater departments,
mm-hmm.
There are some of them that specialize in tech theater, and they train their kids mm-hmm. to be techs. And anything that they can do to help these kids get real world
experience.
They love. And so there are 2 or 3 high schools I contact every year, and I say, we're going to hire this many techs this year. These are when the auditions are, the interviews are. And I always get a lot of kids coming out mm-hmm. every year. And of course, once they work at the magic show once, it's like joining the circus.
Right.
They tell all their friends and they want to come out. But you can find a lot of great techs. And one of the techs that we hired went on to stage manage our show, and he's now a full-time tech. He's working for Freeman, and he's out living the dreams.
So. Well, like in that case, do you pay the school or pay the individual, or do you pay them at all, or they just get some school credit for that? Or?
Oh, we pay them. I pay them hourly for the work we do. And to answer your question... I don't have dancers in the summer. I have one dancer, take that back, in the summer show. But I changed my philosophy on that about 2 years ago, and I started paying everybody for rehearsals
mm-hmm.
because I just didn't feel right about taking their time. And also, I feel like they should be rewarded. So we don't pay them a lot. We pay them like $50 a rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have 4 rehearsals, well, that's an extra $200
sure.
that month that they didn't have before.
Exactly.
And I tell you what, it builds loyalty. And if you want to work with people and you want those people to stay with you, it can't just be about the money. You have to build loyalty. And the other thing that I learned is you have to make the rehearsals fun. if you come down on these people, and I know this from experience, because in the old days it was like, this is my show and it's got to be this way.
That's a good
point.
Yeah.
And the rehearsals weren't any fun. And the reason I know that is because no one would ever come back for the next year. Okay. And then one year I realized, hey, maybe this is me.
Yeah, it's so, not them, it's me.
Yeah. So I, you know, I make sure the rehearsals are fun now. We laugh a lot. We have times now that we're not very productive. And part of me is always like, oh my God, you know, can we get back to this? But I don't do it now. I take
How long are your rehearsals? I mean, a couple hours?
The one last night was 3 hours. It was a little longer than normal. I usually try to keep them to two and schedule some extras rather than just rehearse on and on and on. And if you give people too many things to memorize too, they start to
shut down.
That's a
good point. It's the same thing, I think, like with learning a trick. Or, you know, when I give private lessons, magic lessons, that when I'm doing that, if you're learning more than three things an hour, you forget them all.
Exactly.
You know, it's just information overload. So, yeah, if there are certain... Now, do you have a choreographer, or do you have someone who's one of the dancers saying, here's what I suggest? And
yes. Right now, the dancer who's in my show is a professional dancer and a teacher. So she choreographs the numbers, too. So it's great. Now I get two for one.
Wow,
for
sure.
The show. She handles the bulk of the dancing in the show, because the other girl in the show is an actress, professional actress. And I don't dance, although having said that, she did teach me a 50s dance last year for the Twisters number, and we did this whole 1950s routine. And that was kind of cool, though, because we had all these 50s set pieces in place from the Christmas show back when, and I was trying to repurpose some of that, so we did a big 50s routine. And I did it. I watched her video, but I was frame by frame advancing the video.
Yeah.
Okay, right foot here, left foot here, and it took me forever. It was harder than any trick I have ever learned.
That is funny. That's funny. Because usually when you're watching a magic video, same thing, you might sometimes slow it down to frame by frame. You know, how's he got his fingers, you know, right exactly here? Is there holding a break? Or, you know, how does he do this palm shift or whatever? But
Exactly.
Dance steps, I hadn't thought about that.
It was like learning a pharaoh shuffle with one hand or something. It was ridiculously hard, but you can do it if you spend enough time studying it.
Sure,
and the feet start to go where they're supposed to go.
Well, any other suggestions that you might have for someone who wants to have their own theater or get started as an illusionist? Or
well,
because there are not a lot of illusionists. You know, whenever I talk with, for example, magic conventions, it's more easy to get booked on the stage than it is as a close-up performer, because there are so many people. Everybody's out here today with YouTube videos, and for that matter, most tricks that are being sold are for the close-up guy. There are very few illusions that are out there, and certainly very few new illusions that are coming out. My point being is that it's harder and harder to find an illusionist who will be in a convention. If you go to a convention, there might be one or two large illusions, but for the most part, it's a comedy magician or something. There are not as many, but do you still think that there is room for illusionists?
I do, and I certainly don't want to be controversial, but I think part of the reason that there aren't more illusionists is that it can be really corny if you're not careful. And these days, audiences are inundated with entertainment. They have access to the best now with YouTube and cable TV and live shows and everything. And they're expecting something really, really good and entertaining. And I think a lot of illusionists don't take the time to ask themselves, why should this audience care? How do I make them emotionally invested in what I'm about to do? And so the tendency when you get a big box is to show off.
Yeah.
Is to stand there and say,
you may
worship me now. Yeah. I'm going to put this girl in, and now I'm going to stab this sword through her, and now you may applaud. and I see it over and over. It's always been that way. I used to do that, you know, and I have a tendency to do it now if I'm not careful. But there are lots of different ways to present an illusion. You just have to think outside of the box, so to speak. and ask yourself, okay, what can I do to make this thing fun and entertaining or mysterious or anything, but how can I draw an emotion out of this audience with the illusion that I'm about to do? And I try to do that with almost every illusion that we have. Now, there are some that clearly there's not much you can do other than just present it. But most of them, if you really put your mind to it, you can come up with something engaging.
Yeah. So any tips for people wanting to find a theater, or like what you did, you went to find this resort area?
Well, you have to put yourself in the eyes of the people who are in charge.
Okay.
So you really can't go into it, and I believe this with all my marketing, actually. If you go into the venue with, I'm fantastic, and let me tell you about what the tricks that I'm going to do, and let me tell you about the awards that I've won and how great I am, I mean, they're not going to care. They don't care. They want to know, how is this going to benefit me? So get your presentation in order, put some video together that you can take in on your iPad, something these guys have no imagination. Take some video in that shows you in action, and not just you, but everyone having fun, and get as many testimonials as you can. And this costs nothing. If you take your phone out after the show and you say, hey, can you look in here and tell me what'd you think about the show? And get as many testimonials as you can. Oh, my God, I loved it. Oh, my kids loved it. My grandparents loved it. Right. Everybody loved it. And show the lines of the people going out the door, or really give them a reason to be excited. Imagine that you're that guy going, well, I want that.
Exactly.
You know, I want that in my place. Look at all these happy faces. Look at all these people buying things, and they're spending money. And your pitch shouldn't be, this is how great I am, but listen to what this is going to do for you. You're going to have all these people coming down here that weren't going to come here before. Mm-hmm. They're going to buy these. It's going to be great brand recognition for you guys. I'm going to advertise, and your name is going to be all over. That's free for you. I'm going to do TV appearances. We're going to say Moody Gardens, Moody Gardens, Moody Gardens, or whatever your venue is, over and over and over. Give them as many reasons as you can to be scared to not have you there.
That's good advice, I think, also, Kurt, for restaurant magicians, that if you can put together something to, because you're saying, you know, this is what I have done for other restaurants, and here's, you, because you can have people who can do these video testimonials and how much they like the show and show how busy that the tables were and how much fun they were having and the other tables turning around to see what's happening. You can put together a short video, certainly like that, easy enough to take to another restaurant to say, look what I have done to have this other place successful. I could replicate this for you as well. I'm just trying to carry this not only just for an illusionist, but others who might be
it's
looking
everything.
At this. It's all marketing.
The biggest mistake, I think, that I'm very interested in sales. When people ask me what I do for a living, I say salesman, because I think I do that more than I do magic. Yeah. I had do you remember that show, Wife Swap?
Sure.
Do you ever see that show?
Yeah.
So they called me one time. Did they call you? They wanted to do a show about a magician.
No, they did. I know they had a friend of mine who's a friend of the Magic Word. They had Andrew Portales, who was up in Columbus. Had him as a magician swap with somebody.
I wonder if that was the same show. Well, they called me and they said, we want to do the show, and would you be on it? And I told them, this is going to be the most boring show ever, because it's going to be me on the phone and me on my computer for almost all of it, followed by a little bit of rehearsal and then maybe a show, you know? So, but the point being is that if you're going to sell yourself, whether it's in close-up or illusions or corporate or anything, you have to retrain your mind to sell what we call benefits and not features. So not all of your advertising, but most of it should be geared toward what's in this for you, the buyer, and maybe enough features then to convince you that these benefits are real.
Right.
So all my marketing is focused on, you're going to have a fantastic time. You're going to be so happy. Your boss is going to be happy. Everyone's going to love this. So
when I talk with people about marketing also, one of the things I say is, when you're building your website, look at your web page and just do a word count. How many times do you say I, and how many times do you say you? You know, there should be more use, certainly, than what I can do for you, you know.
Right.
But, well, it is what I can do for you. But it's really, you know, you're going to be successful. You're going to see increase in numbers or whatever it's going to be. So it's more about them, and that all comes down to the benefits. In fact, we're running short on time on
But we
could certainly go off on a whole other podcast talking about marketing because of your brilliance in that, particularly on websites. You're always number one, you know, whenever that somebody's going to do a Google search, that you'll find Kurt Miller in Houston as a magician. And I think in part that's because you're tweaking it every day. You're probably
all the time
working on it. And so that's, again, another podcast, you know, perhaps just talking about marketing and building a website that's successful and everything, you know, like that then too. So as we close out, tell me, what would be your magic word? Because the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So what is your philosophy of life? It doesn't have to be a word. It could be a phrase. You know, what do you live by?
in one word?
No, it could be a phrase. It could take 10 minutes for you to explain what it is, too. And just, you know, what's important? What do you feel that you...
Well, a couple of things. My dad would always tell me, never go halfway.
All in, basically, yeah.
All in. If you're going to do it, yeah. All in or mm-hmm. don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so that's how I operate. I once I make the sale, I never think about the money again. Yeah. I just want to do the absolute best, not necessarily for the client, but for me. I want to do the absolute best that I know how to do, and I want to walk away, even if it wasn't successful going, I did as much as I possibly could have.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as business goes, my philosophy is I always do what I say I'm going to do mm-hmm. every single time. And I tell younger magicians, if you just do that and nothing else, you'll be successful. Always do what you say you're going to do.
Right.
And you'll win.
Yeah, that's good advice. You know, Dan Garrett had told me years ago, and I live by this, is I underpromise and overdeliver.
Absolutely.
You know, give them everything that you can, but certainly everything that you have promised, you know, so.
And from advice. A performing standpoint, I would just add this. When I was back at Magic Island, I had a string of bad shows that went on for about 2 months. And I was blaming it on the audiences. I said, wow, these audiences, what's the deal? They come in here, they don't applaud, they don't laugh. And
yeah.
What's going on here? And one night I went in to the main theater and, there was a ventriloquist in there, and he killed with the same audience that I just had.
Oh.
And I realized, oh my God, it's me.
Yeah, it is me.
And I talked to him afterwards, and I said, what is your secret? And he said, I have a button on the back of this little case that stares at me during the whole show, and it says, have fun, in huge letters. Don't fake it. Don't phone it in. Genuinely have fun. If I'm not having fun, I will stop the show and talk to the audience or do whatever I have to do until I have fun. And I adopted that philosophy from that night on, and I have not had one single bad show since then.
Good advice.
If you have fun and you just have the time of your life, audiences can smell it if you don't really want to be there.
Good point.
If you're phoning it in,
yeah.
They can smell it. If you go out there with... Oh, man, are we going to have a great time.
Yeah.
You'll have a great show every
That's
time.
What that it factor is, I think, you know.
Absolutely.
If you're having fun, they'll have fun.
Every time.
Yeah. Kurt, thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Boy,
it's been a
pleasure. A lot of good stuff here. Appreciate you being a guest here this week.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
So until next time, that was Kurt Miller, and this is Scotty out.
Wow, lots of great ideas there from Kurt Miller, and I want to thank him for being my guest today. And if you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more from Kurt about how that he does keep his name at the top of the rankings when it comes to Google searches and how he updates his website and different things he does as far as social media to keep his name ever present in the name in the minds and also on the screens of many of his clients, just drop me a note. That is scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. And we can get back together with Kurt and talk a little bit more about some of that social engineering, which I think is quite interesting also. But I hope that you have a good takeaway from this as far as planning for your next show, whether it's going to be for a close-up show at a restaurant or whether that you're going to be planning for a corporate show or whether it's going to be something big like this that's going to be a holiday show that's going to be a big illusion show or something. So anyhow, thanks again, Kurt. Great ideas and good talking with you. And I hope everybody learned as much as I did this time. Well, now it's time for a few product reviews of tricks that come to me from Murphy's Magic Supplies. And as always, these are always available from your favorite magic dealer, which of course should include the magicwordpodcast.com. If you just go over to our magic store, you can find these and many other fine Murphy's Magic products that are available. But today we're going to run through three different items, all of which are card effects and all of which are DIY. First up today is the President's Choice, which is a Sans Mind Creative Lab production. And as I said, this is a DIY project. It's something that can be done, as it says, 360 degrees. It's a really good effect. And it does take some time as far as the setup time for it and making it. It's just a one-time thing once that you have it done. And it says probably takes about 15 minutes to make it. Well, first of all, you have to put everything all together as far as your glue and your scissors and everything else that you're going to need in order to put it together. And you'll also need to have three of your bills. I suspect this is only good really for U.S. currency. It wouldn't work for euros or pounds or other denominations. So it is American dollar bills that this is made for, and so you will have to destroy a few bills. But the nice thing is that at the end you do have something to hand out and leave with your spectator. You can get that back if you wish, or leave that with them. And that's another thing, is that you are supplied with several of the cards that are the stickers, but you can always make some of your own. Just you can reproduce those and put them on some sticker material, run them through your printer, and you can make some and put them on dollar bills and hand those out. I mean, it's a nice thing in which that if you were to borrow a bill from somebody, that way that you are not, you know, giving up a dollar every time you do it. You borrow a bill, and then you can switch it for the gimmick one that you're going to later have with the card in the mouth. Let me explain what the effect is. Again, it's called the President's Choice. Essentially, that someone selects a playing card, then you show a dollar bill, and you're going to have George Washington, who is on the front of the bill, to assist you. And like in my presentation, I was thinking of doing something kind of like a bullet catch, except it's going to be a card catch. And just like with a bullet catch, which you catch the bullet in your mouth, here you catch a card in your mouth. And the cool thing is that kind of like in Paul Harris's shades, the president has some shades that go up and down. Anyhow, the mouth opens and closes, kind of like a little ventriloquist vent figure. Anyhow, the idea is that you see the mouth opening and closing, say, okay, open your mouth, get ready to catch this, and then when you riffle the cards, you just stuff the bill into the deck of cards, and as you pull it out, you now have the card, which is their selected card, a smaller variation of that, of course, a little sticker, which is on the bill that looks like it's coming out of George Washington's mouth. You can hand that out, and it is done. I will say there is a lot of work. They say a 15-minute setup took me about 2 hours. It depends how good your eyes are, and also of all the little intricate things that as far as gluing and cutting and everything, and trying to get this aligned perfectly, and my fingers kept getting sticky and all this. It just took a little bit longer than I had thought, but it really was worth the time once that I was finished with the product. I like it a lot. There are a couple of little variations that they will show you on the DVD that comes with it. You get the DVD and some of the things that you need for the gimmick, specifically the little stickers with the cards that come with it, and so it and the necessary magnets that come with it. Magicians love magnets, and I'm no different. It's a lot of fun to play with them, and these are very important that you don't lose them. So I would say whenever that you're working on this project, make sure that you have a clean counter space so that if you drop it, that it's not going to the floor or sticking to something metal and you lose it. So make sure that you have a clean area where you're going to be able to construct this gimmick. But again, once you have it, you can use this over and over, except for the one that you would hand out if you want to leave it with them. Again, this is called The President's Choice by Sans Minds. And personally, I think this is just a cute thing, and I'm not really one to carry around additional stuff, but you do have to carry a gimmick card and this gimmick bill, and I think it's worth making some room in your pockets for the pocket management in order to do this little thing, because it's not just a card trick. It turns into something else entirely different that, again, can be left as a souvenir if you wish. And so I pretty much highly recommend this. It's pretty cool. The President's Choice by Sans Minds. Next up today is Peter Egging's Feel and Seal, or it's Feel and Seal, and instantly you get to reseal a deck of cards. Essentially, you have someone open a deck of fresh cards. That is, they take the cellophane off, they break the seal, they take out a card, they can sign it. You then replace the cards in the deck as they're doing that, and just you quick as a wink, basically, when you shake the cards, you show the flap open, the flap disappears. That is, that they're now sealed. You can hand it out, and the deck is sealed and has not only the cellophane around it, but also the factory seal on that as well. In the original presentation that they show you where they're performing this for somebody, they leave that with the person as well. And you can say, okay, your card has been taken out of the deck and signed, and so you can just leave it with them to say, you know, thanks very much. You know, you can keep this as a memory. You don't need to open this, you know, to prove it, but basically there'll be one card missing, which is the one that you had signed, so they have a souvenir. In reality, I don't believe that you would leave that with them, because the gimmick that you are using and that you had spent a lot of time to make is now actually part of the sealed deck. Without going into exposure of any of the detail about how this works, there are some elastic bands and things that are involved with this, in which that's, it appears to be actually, well, it is resealed, that you can take a look at it, but there is a part of it that's not completely, I guess. Also, there is a deck switch involved, so it's not like that you're using the very same deck. So with that provision, you should know that there is a deck switch involved, but the gimmick itself is clever. It's not something I think that I would do, and after I'd spent 2 hours making the other thing, I didn't go into a lot of time of making this, because it is another one of these DIY projects in which you're going to have to thread some elastic thread through a needle, and then kind of make your own gimmick with the things that are provided there, and then fiddle around with it and have to have an iron to seal the deck and everything. And besides that you're only provided with 3 new cellophanes. Of course, they explain how that you can use the existing cellophane that you had taken off the other deck. And anyhow, without getting into a lot of detail, it's one of those things that they do give you enough for a few more presentations. But if you're going to be doing this very often and then leaving it with somebody, then it will, you can actually make, I think, as I said, 3 different gimmicks with this. So you have enough, so it should last for a while as far as the gimmick itself. Anyhow, it takes a while, it looks like, to make this. I didn't make it, so I can't say exactly how long it would take, but I know it will take a little bit of time. But it's just that it's not something I believe that I would do personally. I think this is an okay effect as far as the sealing of it. There was a lot of time in the presentation trying to emphasize, remember the beginning of this trick, and then because you want the spectator to remember that they had opened the deck, so that way when it goes back to being resealed, they don't forget that beginning of the effect. And so there seems to be a lot of emphasis on that. Anyhow, it's by Peter Egink, called Feel and Seal, and it's not for me. I would recommend it for some, but not for my presentation. A little bit too much going on there, plus with the deck switch and everything else, there are a lot of other things, I think, in my opinion, that are stronger than this. So it's not necessarily recommended. Finally, from Sans Mines, another product that we did one Sans Mines earlier. We complete this with one that's called Sharpshooter. It was actually something that was sent into them by soliciting other new material, and this came to them from Jonathan Wooten. The effect is basically where that you can have a deck of cards. You shuffle up a little bit, you have a card selected, and then you place it onto either the table or the floor or the street if you're outdoors, but some flat surface basically. Then you have a rubber band, which you then put into kind of between your fingers, spreading it out so it's a rectangle surrounding the cards. The advantage of this is that the spectator actually is the one who apparently does the magic, because you have that person then hold their fingers at the 4 corners of that rubber band as you take your hands away, and whenever they're ready, they let go of the rubber band, and essentially that it cuts to their cards. So when the rubber band snaps and the cards are disheveled, that's the card that the rubber band is on top of, the rubber band is underneath their selected card. So when you turn over the balance of the cards, you can see that that's their selected card. It is a very clever thing, a very easy thing. I will say that this completes our DIY, but this is the easiest gimmick to make and will only just take a few moments of your time. And again, this is something then that you can use then from now on for this particular effect. And again, you would have have to switch this with another cold deck or something if you want to do other card tricks. The whole deck is not gimmick, just a portion of it, but it is something that you can easily ring in as you're doing a bunch of other effects, or even this little gimmick that you make as well that you can bring in and then take it back out. But nevertheless, it is a cool little trick and something that is easy to make, just a few minutes. And again, it's called Sharpshooter by Sans Mines, and I would recommend it. Well, there you have it. Three for Thursday. A couple of good ones and one not so good for me. A little bit finicky. Anyhow, that's the way that it is for me. As I said, I thank you guys for listening to these reviews, and I hope that they help in your purchasing decisions. And also, when you do decide to purchase something, I know there are a lot of online shops you can check out, but be sure to check out ours at the Magic Store here on the magicwordpodcast.com. And if you don't see anything there that you were wanting to buy, just drop me an email, and I can add that to the site, so this way you can click on it and order that also. My email address is scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. If you already do have an online store and you are a dedicated customer of that particular person, great. Continue to work with them. I applaud you for your commitment and dedication. And also, we need to keep everybody in business. And also, then, if you can't go and support us by buying something through the Magic Word Podcast, you can always help us by buying your stuff on Amazon by using our affiliate program. Again, go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There is an Amazon affiliate tab. Click on there, and whenever that you click on the appropriate tab, it will take you then over to the Amazon page, and anything you purchase, a portion of that will stay with the Magic Word. So, anyhow, there were three different reviews for this week, and I hope that you enjoyed it, and good luck and good magic. So there you have it, another full podcast, and I hope that you enjoyed the discussion we had with Kurt Miller, also learning a little bit more about the Magic Island, and also a few trick reviews. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that it's all or nothing at all. You need to be all in everything you do. Put forth the best effort you can. This is Scotty out.